Okay, so as we look at Job, we are diving into Job. Obviously, we're not in a series on Job. Probably most of us are not very familiar with Job. So let's just get a little bit of context. I'd like you to turn first back to Job chapter 1 with me, because the key to Job is really the start and the end. So we need to just look there. Look at verse 1. Of Job chapter 1, which says, "In the land of Uz there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and he shunned evil." Okay, that's important. Job is a righteous man. He's a godly man. He's described as a blameless man. This is what the author tells us, and we learn in this chapter as well that's God's verdict on his life. We know that. Blameless doesn't mean sinless. He is, of course, a sinner, just like everyone else is a sinner. But the key thing is that there's no great evil in his life that warrants what's about to happen to him. Okay, so in chapter 1, what happens is basically God allows Satan to afflict Job. So all Job's children are killed, all his stuff gets stolen, and he is ill. So this great suffering comes on him, but yet God's verdict of him is that he is godly, he is blameless, he is a righteous man. And basically the rest of the book is Job and his friends kind of wrestling and struggling to understand what's happened to him. And the reason they struggle and the reason they wrestle with this is because they don't really have a framework to understand how a righteous man can suffer. So obviously it's difficult for them and difficult for Job to understand what's happening to him. They sort of assume the world, that God kind of manages the world by punishing the guilty and rewarding the righteous on a regular basis. And so it's difficult for them to understand what's happened to Job. And towards the end of the book, we're not going to turn there, but Rupert very helpfully read from there earlier, Job becomes frustrated and he complains to God. And God does respond to Job. God speaks to Job, and God basically says, "Look, all those things that Rupert read, and more. You know, where were you, Job, when I created the world, etc." In other words, Job, you're not qualified to complain about my justice. And also, God does vindicate Job, say that he is blameless, he is godly. Now we are diving into chapter 9. Chapter 9, as it starts, then Job replied. Okay, this is Job's words. All of chapter 9 is Job's words. And the obvious question is, who is Job replying to? Well, chapter 8 is a man called Bildad, who is one of Job's friends. And Bildad has just said in chapter 8, essentially, that ungodly people perish, and that God does not reject a blameless man. That's his kind of thesis. And Job is replying to him. Basically, that isn't really going to help Job much. So Job, let's just look at these first three verses as a kind of introduction to Job 9. Job replied, "Indeed, I know that this is true," but he knows that it's true that God rewards righteousness and punishes evil. he agrees with that principle. "But how can mere mortals prove their innocence before God?" You might have, "How can a mere mortal be righteous before God? Though they wish to dispute with him, they could not answer him once in 1,000 times." His question is, how can a man be righteous, or how can a mere mortal prove his innocence before God? You see, what he wants is chapter 1. And essentially, he wants God to say, "Yes, Job, you're innocent of some great sin that warrants this judgment." But he doesn't know that. We know that as the reader, but Job doesn't know that. He never understands why all of this happens. He's not heard this from God. And his friends here are accusing him of some great sin, some great evil in his life that he must repent of, that's brought this judgment on him. So you can understand his frustration. In verse 3, he wants to dispute with God. These are kind of legal terms. He wants, of course, his innocence to be proven. That's what he wants. And we might frame this kind of question very differently, but I think it's familiar to us. I think we see this kind of thing around us today, maybe it sounds like this: I'll believe in God when I can see him face to face. Or maybe it sounds like this: if God really is good, why is there so much suffering in the world, and why doesn't he explain that to me? Or perhaps it simply sounds like this: why is this happening to me? There are events that are put on, perhaps by Christian Union, with titles like, if you could ask God one question, what would it be? You know, sometimes there's a box and people can write questions and put them in. And those boxes get filled up because everyone has an idea of a question they want to ask God, don't they? And Christians claim to know God. Christians claim to know God, not just to know about God. Christians claim that it's possible to know God on a personal level. Is that possible? Is that arrogant? Is that misguided? How do we read Job in the light of that? Well, let's have a look. I've divided this into three sections. I haven't been organized enough to have a handout for you, so I'll read them to you, and if you're taking notes, you can write them down. The first section is verse 4 to 13. Verse 4 to 13, I've called it Wonder at God's Awesome Power. Wonder at God's Awesome Power. That's a verb, wonder. It's an imperative. You must wonder at God's awesome power. So Job, he may be questioning God in his suffering and in his frustration, but his thinking here is anchored in what he knows to be true about God. As we read verses 4 to 13, we'll see. There are kind of echoes of Genesis there as he looks at the creation around him. I think also he's just looking at things that he can see in the world around him. And ultimately he's saying God is too big, too powerful for a mortal man to come before him. Let's just go through them together. Verse 4, his wisdom is profound, his power is vast. Verse 5, he moves mountains without their knowing it, overturns them in his anger. Verse 6, he shakes the earth from its place. He makes their pillars, he makes its pillars tremble. As I was saying to the children in the Natural History Museum, you can walk into a room and they've replicated an earthquake. So I think it's in Japan, they've got readings from an earthquake, and you walk into this room and it's like it's all laid out like a shop. And then everything starts shaking, and the room starts shaking, and things are wobbling on the shelves. And you just have this sense of, if you're in that situation, there's nothing you can do. The whole world is shaking. And Job says it's God who does that. God is behind it. In verse 7, he speaks to the sun, and it does not shine. He seals off the light of the stars. The other day, in the kind of run-up to dinner time, the children were struggling a bit, or maybe I was struggling a bit, but there was some struggle, and I decided to that we should go out. They should go out on a little walk, and it was nice and clear. And I thought, oh, maybe if we can go on a little walk, we can look at the stars. So we got all our kind of shoes and hats and coats on and things, and we went out, and then we were in this field, and we looked up and we saw nothing, because while we were doing all that, the clouds had just kind of rolled over. And I think we saw one star, and then we came back. And it just reminds you, doesn't it, that actually we're pretty small. And if God chooses that people in Oddown are not going to see the stars at 5, that's his choice, and we can't do anything about it. There's a story of a man called Guillaume Le Gentil. He was a French man, and in the 18th century, there were these very important scientific ideas to try and measure a transit of Venus. So that's to watch the planet Venus going across the sun. And if you do that from different points on the Earth, you can work out how far away things in the solar system are and how fast things are going. And people got very excited about it. So this man went all the way to India to watch this transit of Venus, and he missed it because he was on the boat. Anyway, he got to India and he thought, there's another one in 8 years' time. I might as well wait here. So he waited in India for 8 years, and he built an observatory in India so that he could watch the next transit of Venus. And then when it came, it was cloudy. and you just think, wow, we're so small, aren't we? And this guy, this poor guy, I'm sure it wasn't funny for him, but, you know, If God decides, no, sorry, you're not going to see that. That's up to him, isn't it? And that's what Job is saying. He does these things. That's how awesome he is. Verse 8 is reminiscent of Genesis, isn't it? He stretches out the heavens. He stretched them out. He put them there. It's him who does that. Verse 9, he made the stars. We've thought about stars a bit already. When you think about the stars, and even if you don't understand the astrophysics, which I certainly don't, but maybe Henry does, and he can talk to us about it later. But the stars are kind of huge distances apart, and they're massive, aren't they? But even just looking up at them, you know, they're beautiful and they're amazing, and you can see there's something special. And when you think about the sort of pinnacles of human achievement, people will maybe think about that moment when Neil Armstrong stood on the moon, or whatever it is, and you think, well, actually, that's pretty puny, isn't it, when you think that God made all the stars. And the best thing that we can do as a human race, the highest achievement we can do is play golf on the moon. That's as good as it gets. And that's, you know, that's like going to the co-op compared to going to the nearest star, you know. And God didn't, you know, we're not just about talking about traveling to the stars. God made the stars. God made the stars. Human beings can't even contemplate making the stars, making a single star. You know, it's just beyond our wildest dreams. And this is what Job is kind of pointing out poetically as he speaks here. So no wonder verse 10, he says, God performs wonders that cannot be fathomed, miracles that cannot be counted. There are so many unanswered questions, so many things we can't fathom, even our age of technology. If you read books on astronomy, like Josiah's book on astronomy, you'll find a lot of things where it says, we think this and we think that and it looks like this, but there are so many things that we don't know, that we can't fathom, and it's God who performs those things. What's interesting as well about verse 10 is it's actually a quote. Job is quoting his friend Eliphaz, who said these very words back in chapter 5. So we're supposed to notice at this point, we've seen these words before. And Eliphaz in chapter 5, as he says these words, he's saying that Job should appeal to God. If he has a case, he should appeal to God, because God is so amazing and he performs these wonders that cannot be fathomed. But here, Job is using exactly the same words to say no. No, I can't, because God is so amazing, is so awesome, is so other. So verse 11, he says, when he passes me by, I cannot see him. When he goes by, I cannot perceive him. If he snatches away, who can stop him? Who can say to him, what are you doing? You know, God is untouchable, Job is saying. He's unreachable. It's not like a person you pass in the street and you can say, oh, sorry, excuse me, can you just, or you can stop someone. Job is saying, you can't do that with God. It reminds me of what you see on TV when there's a royal wedding or some kind of big event and the Queen is going past. And you see all these people, and I sometimes wonder why they're there, because all they can do is stand, can't they, behind, and there are those kind of metal barriers that they stand behind, and maybe they're waving flags, and they, you know, they get interviewed and say, where have you come from? And they've come from Edinburgh or somewhere all the way to watch the Queen. And the best that they can hope for is that they're stood next to this barrier, and the Queen drives by, and maybe she's waving in their direction as she goes by. That's the best it's going to get for, isn't it, for them. That's the best they can hope for. You know, they can't say, oh, hello, could you just answer my question, or could I just talk to you about this? The Queen for them is unapproachable. They can't access her. Presumably they want to, and that's why they're there, and they want to be as close as they can, but they're not going to get very close. They're not really going to relate to her, are they? They can't approach her. There's a barrier that is stopping them from doing that. And so verse 13, he concludes and talks about God not restraining his anger. Even the cohorts of Rahab, as we thought with the children, this cohorts of Rahab idea is about sea monsters, these big beasts of the sea. I can show you this picture again because it's quite fun and it's got lots of teeth in it. So these big sea monsters, they aren't around anymore. And we dig up bones of them. But Job lived a long time ago. Maybe he saw these creatures with his own eyes. These are big sea monsters. They're bigger than Tyrannosaurus Rex or whatever. They're huge. Basically, Job is saying, these are the most powerful things in creation. And yet, what do? At God's feet, they cower at his feet. They cower at his feet. The message is that God is awesomely powerful compared to us. So where does that leave us? How do we respond when we've read these verses like we've just read? Well, firstly, I think we should join Job in his awe here at God's power. And we're surrounded by voices in our society that tell us that all of these things happen by chance. That an earthquake happens by chance. That the stars happen by chance over millions of years. That everything is in place because it just happened to be that way. And Job reminds us, what we need to be reminded, that God is behind all this. We should join Job in his awe at God's power. I think also we should worship God as we read words like these. It does us great good. Even when we're suffering, perhaps especially when we're suffering, it gives us good. It does us good to have a dose of reality and a reminder of the greatness of God. We should worship God because he is mighty and awesome. And also at Christmas time, this time of year, we're reminded, and when we choose to use Christmas to remind ourselves of the baby Jesus in the womb and of the baby Jesus in the manger. And as we read a passage like this, we can marvel at that kind of juxtaposition that Jesus is God. Jesus surrendered all this kind of power, this kind of authority to become a mere baby. You know, he surrendered being in that place where these sea monsters would cower at his feet to be a baby. And sea monsters don't cower at the feet of a baby, do they? He surrendered that and became so helpless and so dependent. And he did that partly as an answer to the cry of Job, who longs to be able to relate to his God, not to see him as a distant and incomprehensible and unapproachable God. And as we saw in Mark's account is reminiscent of these verses Job talks about God treading on the waves of the sea and then passing by and snatching away. Jesus in Mark walks out to the disciples, he treads on the waves of the sea, he's about to pass by them, and they're afraid, they're frightened. But Jesus stops at their fear and he gets in to the boat with them. Wow, Job would be staggered, wouldn't he? I mean, Job is vindicated by God at the end of the book of Job, but the ultimate resolution is found in the Lord Jesus, who stopped and got into the boat. He didn't snatch away, unapproachable, untouchable, but who related to man. That was verses 4 to 13, wonder at God's awesome power. Now we're going to look at the next section, verse 14 down to 24. 14 to 24, I've called it trust in God's wise sovereignty. Trust in God's wise sovereignty, verse 14 to 24. Verse 14 talks about, Job says, how then can I dispute with him? Dispute is linking us back to verse 3. Job disputing with God. He's doing that deliberately, or the author is doing that deliberately. So the conclusion is, there is no way to dispute with God. It is hopeless, thinks Job, to imagine being able to question God or expecting to be heard by God or answered by God, because he's this huge God who stretches out the heavens and makes the stars and things, and Job is just Job. By verse 15, I think sin is in view. Though I were innocent, I could not answer him. I could only plead with my judge for mercy. He cannot protest his innocence, as Job imagines going before God, blameless as he is. He can only cry out for mercy, and that is our situation. And as he contemplates that, he just imagines being crushed before God's holiness. There's this kind of barrage, relentless. Verse 16, 17, 18, he would crush me with a storm. He would not let me catch my breath. He would overwhelm me with misery. If it's a matter of strength, he's mighty. If it's a matter of justice, who can challenge him or who can summon him? Job is overawed by God. Verse 20, he imagines he can't even speak before God and remain guiltless. So no wonder, verse 21, he's in despair. Although I'm blameless, I have no concern for myself. I despise my own life. Those are the words of a man in despair, aren't they? And then verse 22, his words change a bit, his thinking changes a bit. He's now saying, this is my problem. Verse 22, he destroys both the blameless and the wicked. He's saying bad things happen seemingly indiscriminately to everyone, including, presumably, him, Job. And he recognizes that God is sovereign over all these things. Verse 24, when a scourge brings sudden death, when there's some kind of plague that sweeps over a place, then both the righteous and the wicked are being killed by it. God mocks the despair of the innocent, says Job. When a land falls into the hands of the wicked, he doesn't pull any punches, does he, Job? When there's wickedness in a land, he, that is God, blindfolds its judges, saying it's God who's done this. And just in case you want to challenge that and say, well, then he says, if it's not he, then who is it? If it's not God, who is it? He says, of course it's God. God is in control over evil. It must be him. He's behind this. And yet I've called this point, trust in God's wise sovereignty. Why have I done that? Look at verse 4 from Job's lips. God's wisdom is profound. God's wisdom is profound. Job said it himself. It's true. Even in a land where the judges are blindfolded by corruption, even in a land where there is plague wiping out hundreds of people, God is sovereign and God is wise. And in God's wisdom, godly people do suffer in this world. And we need to trust in his sovereignty. We need to trust in his wisdom. We need to trust in his justice. Even at the end of the book of Job, God never explains to Job why this happened to him. He doesn't explain to Job, oh well, I allowed Satan to afflict you because of this, this, and this. Job never is told that. We need to trust God's wise sovereignty. We also need to be in mind of something that Job couldn't see clearly, and that is our eternal future, which we, with the New Testament and the rest of the Bible, we see much more clearly, don't we? What it means to be a follower of God. What it means is that any injustice or any suffering that we experience now is temporary. And it will give way to a future where final justice is done by God. And where pain and suffering, death are ended forever for those who follow God. Okay, that was the second section, trust in God's wise sovereignty. Finally, rejoice in the glimpsed hope of a mediator. This is verses 25 to 31. Rejoice in the glimpsed hope of a mediator. Job launches into this poetic description in verse 25 of how quick and how brief our lives are. He says, my days are swifter than a runner. Imagine someone just running past you. They fly away without a glimpse of joy. They skim past like boats of papyrus. Papyrus is a very light material. These boats would be made out of papyrus and they just kind of get blown along. It's a sort of speedboat of the ancient world. Like eagles swooping down on their prey. If you've ever seen a bird of prey hovering and then it sees what it wants to eat and it just swoops. And it's gone. He's saying, my life is so fleeting. It's pointless. Verse 27, well, if I just pretend that everything's okay and I say I'm going to smile anyway, well, that's no use, is it? There's no point in doing that. Verse 28, I'll just dread my sufferings. Look at verse 28 and 29. Job feels that God has declared him guilty. That's his framework. He's suffering, therefore he must be guilty. Verse 29, why should I struggle in vain? If he follows Bildad's conclusions in chapter 8, that blessing comes to the righteous, suffering comes to the guilty. Even if he had the opportunity to face God, he would be afraid for all his blamelessness, Job is aware of the weight of guilt and of sin that we all bear. Verse 30, if he washed himself with soap, my hands with cleansing powder, it wouldn't do any good. He'd just end up in a slime pit again. Soap and talcum powder are pretty good, but they're not going to help, are they? When it comes to coming before the living God, they won't help Job. And that is what causes a barrier to any relationship with God. Verse 32, he is not a mere mortal like me that I might answer him. He's not a man like me that I might answer him. Job here, he's torn, there's a tension. He's, on the one hand, he's longing for God. He's longing to be able to relate to God, to complain to God, to ask God questions. And on the other hand, he is in terror of God. He's afraid of God because he sees how awesome and how mighty and how holy and how perfect God is. And so he says in verse 33, if only there was someone to mediate between us, someone to bring us together, someone to remove God's rod from me so that this terror would frighten me no more. If only there were an arbitrator. Some translations have someone to lay his hand both our heads. You can imagine just someone laying hands on two people's heads and trying to reconcile them. If only there was a go-between. If only there was a mediator who could remove that rod of fear that Job feels. And this is the glimpse of hope that we have in this passage. It's the hope of a mediator. And that's ultimately what is needed. And that's what Job sees clearly in this moment. Clearly we can't come before God. So we're left in this dark fear of him, only seeing him as awesome and distant and unapproachable. And Job's words point us forward to the answer, which of course is found in the Lord Jesus Christ, the mediator that Job longed for, the one who can lay his hand on us both. Because sin is real, and Job is right in verse 30. We would end up being crushed before God's holy anger, as dirty as we started with, if we try to clean up our act, if we try to make ourselves good enough to come before God. But there was one who was completely blameless, who was completely sinless, one like Job, who faced suffering that he didn't deserve. You see, Jesus genuinely faced injustice from God when he died on the cross. And he did that so that, verse 30, we're not left with our futile efforts to cleanse ourselves. Instead, we're washed by the Lord Jesus, an effectual washing, so that we can come before God. So Job says in verse 32, he is not a man like us. No, Job, he is a man like us. Not so that we can face God in court and air our complaints, but so that Jesus the man did face God in court, as it were, that he willingly suffered injustice from God's hand, so that the rod of terror might be removed from us. God decided that his rod of terror would fall on Jesus in order that we might be spared. And Jesus decided to suffer what he did not deserve in order that we might receive an everlasting blessing that we don't deserve. See, Jesus is the ultimate answer to this. Jesus is the ultimate answer to the problem of suffering as well. And we remember at Christmas that Jesus, who is the answer to Job's cry, who opens the way to the end of guilt and shame and fear and suffering forever. We sang earlier, didn't we? The hopes and the fears of all the years are met in thee tonight. Not just because a baby was born, but because of who that baby was, that he was God himself come to end our guilt and our shame and our suffering.